This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Sheet lightning.
Ball lightning.
Greased lightning.
Lightning round!
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
So, Ken, it's an exciting episode number this time. Guess what number we've gotten up to?
Oh, I've lost track, Robin.
Well, it's a good thing that I keep a script because, Ken, this is episode 700. 700th show.
That's got magic zeros at the end.
Yes. It feels like only... not yesterday, but a couple of yesterdays ago since we got started, and now we're all the way up to episode 700. Who could have thunk it? And so everybody knows the drill. If you're longtime listeners, our anniversary episodes are devoted to
Lightning Round
questions. We've solicited all sorts of quick questions from our beloved Patreon backers, and maybe even a few people who are following us on Patreon for free this time. We'll see if we get to those. The beloved backers, of course, get first in line. I have pruned some of the questions, as always. There might be a couple of what's your favorite this or that, but I tend to pull those out because they're not as exciting as others. There are others. If you had a really great question and you don't hear it, that's probably because it was so great it deserves
it's a whole segment.
So I've reserved some things for later.
It's a gentle rainstorm round, not a whole lightning round.
Exactly. And we're here for lightning round. So let's get to it. Ken, the first question comes from Sean.
Beloved Patreon backer Sean asks, what is one thing you have done recently that has noticeably improved your life, personal or professional, gaming, cooking, whatever? Robin?
I have finally made the leap, or rather my wife Valerie and I have made the leap together into the exciting world of 4K discs. Mm. So we've gotten back into physical media by selecting a few titles, the ones that, and they have to meet criteria. It has to be one that we don't already have on Blu-ray. If we have it on DVD, it's eligible, but that's not all it has to be eligible for our 4K collection.
Right.
It also has to be something that we'll rewatch enough to justify that. And so we've gotten into the glorious world of perfect, gorgeous, true 4K, which of course you never really get when it's compressed on streaming, no matter what your set tells you, no matter what your streaming service tells you. And so you can sit there and go, oh, Cary Grant's coat. Look at the weave on his jacket.
Yes,
so,
textiles fans love 4K.
Yes, you get really into textiles. And this has led to another thing, because one of the things we bought, you know, because I just mentioned Cary Grant, is the great new 15-film Hitchcock 4K set. So we had a Hitchcock retrospective, all of the things we had in 4K. But then Ballard decided, hey, we should keep up this Friday Night Retrospective thing. And so we're doing Spike Lee. Mm. We're not doing Spike Lee exclusively on 4K, although I did pick up Do the Right Thing because very few of his films are actually on that format. And not all of them are ones that we would rewatch a whole bunch of times. But it's been also very fun and exciting to have a new ritual. And you understand a filmmaker a lot more if you watch their films all together in succession. So that's been a lot of fun. Your answer, Ken?
My answer is that I have, for the first time, a stainless steel skillet. And I am getting very, I don't say good, but I can see good from where I am in terms of cooking meat on my stainless steel skillet. And I feel like there is a little bit more of a practice climb to make, but I can see the sunny uplands of perfect steak and perfect hamburgers and perfect pork chops and perfect everything else coming out because you get the heat retention of cast iron and the quick action of carbon steel. And it's there in beautiful, beautiful stainless steel, which, as the name implies, is stainless. So cleanup is a cinch.
Lightning round!
Friedrich Barnison asks, what's the first crossover that you can think of between the Food Hut and Tradecraft Hut?
Well, I suppose the first crossover that everyone thinks of is the wonderful Queen Julia Child, who worked for the OSS doing counterintelligence and also rumoredly helping build deadly devices into simple culinary items. I don't know how much that is true, whether or not she was just, you know, doing counterintelligence work in Ceylon, where she was. But certainly Queen Julia would be the first in terms of the foremost crossover between the Food Hut and the Tradecraft Hut. Robin?
I was thinking more in terms of like a crossover segment. So I was thinking we would talk about Len Deaton's illustrated cookbook.
I was hoping that you would say that because that was my other answer if it wasn't Queen Julia Child. And those are great and I own them.
Right. Well, I assumed that was going to be your answer. So my answer was going to be a survey of cocktails in Fleming and beyond.
Lightning round!
Beloved Patreon backer George Poles asks, what unimaginable force can explain 700 episodes of Kartas without covering psych warfare expert, writer of fabulous science fiction, Paul Leinberger, better known as Cordwainer Smith? And did I, Ken, have anything to do with the disappearance of Leinberger's notebook containing 10,000 years of future history? Robin?
Well, I can't speak to the notebook.
Right.
But I think the imaginable forces that have explained it is, first of all, the super beloved backer who actually proposed this was a little too clever and didn't put in the Cordwainer Smith part. And so I didn't make that connection. But also, I think when I did make the connection, the thing is I would have to go and read a bunch of Cordwainer Smith, which I think I read in little isolated stories here and there when I was, you know, decades ago. But, and the problem with that is I have to think the next time I'm picking a book to pick that book as homework for the segment. And in general, segments that require one or the other of us to read entire books are ones that unfortunately sift down to the bottom. But that's the imaginable answer, Ken.
Right. The unimaginable answer is that if we did a segment on Paul Leinberger, a.k.a. Cordwainer Smith, it might derange our benevolent Norstrilian future, and they don't like stuff that deranges the future, which may or may not be why either I or the Knights Templar stole Paul Leinberger's notebook while he was sunning himself on the island of Rhodes.
Lightning round!
Kevin J. Nemroni asks, how often does Ken prune his book orchard? And does he have any helpful hints on deciding what to deacquisition?
Well, according to some people who live in my house, I don't prune it often enough. According to other people who live in my house, I prune it as often as I possibly can. So there you go. Science can't say how often I prune my book orchard. No one, none can know. The only helpful hint that I have is use. If a book has been on my shelves and it is not of clear reference utility for, you know, decades and I haven't cracked it, maybe it can go to a farm upstate. And that has happened with one of the auxiliary Elliptony shelves or two that were down in the basement. And when I was reorganizing those shelves, I noticed that I hadn't looked at any of those books since I'd moved them there, a sign that I did not necessarily need them. And likewise, I had a number of at the time trenchant books about America's political situation in the 90s, which, since it's not far enough back to be history and not quite frankly interesting enough to be history and is nohow relevant to politics anymore, most of those also got deaccessioned because many of them cannot write as felicitously as William F. Buckley, who gets to stay on increasingly as literature, just like H.L. Mencken does.
Yeah, I have no book orchard. I have barely a book deck garden. But what I've noticed is that if I get rid of any piece of nonfiction, I will immediately need it, like, you know, 2 months later.
This is known. This is known.
Yes. We've pruned our fiction shelves pretty thoroughly because the question is, will I ever read this again? And increasingly, my question is, will I read it again in paper? Because I really prefer ebooks. For one thing, they don't suck all of the moisture out of my fingers and crack up my fingers. So chances are, when I'm pruning things, I'm pruning fiction.
Lightning round!
Jonathan Laufersweiler asks, how do you bridge the gap between a vibe-centered aesthetic vision, e.g. a world inspired by Iron Maiden album art, and a gameable, the PCs are X, who do Y, mission? Robin?
So Jonathan is mentioning the core activity, and that is, in my view, central to any role-playing game that is going to work long-term for more than a couple of sessions. So I think you do it in three stages. So you take inspiration from your vibe to answer the question, who are the PCs and what they'll be doing? And so you look at your Iron Maiden albums and see what appears to be happening on them or what might happen if player characters wandered into them, and then come up with your core activity. And then from there, go back and build the vibe on top of that. And so that gives you both your theme and your underlying through line.
Yeah, I think that's basically what it is you immerse yourself in your vibe, and then you figure out what in that vibe can withstand a serial adventure story. And in Iron Maiden album art, it would be, you're probably big rig truckers, or maybe you're driving a cool van. You're in some sort of horrible landscape that some sort of death magic has blown up on, so you're fighting a lot of grinning skeletons. And obviously, everything is very, very metal. And so I assume that means that you fight them with axes that are also guitars. And I feel like you could get a sort of a Troika-style set of encounters out of that. And that could go either, maybe you do a specific story. You have to go from one side of Britain to the other, or one side of America to the other, through the Iron Maiden zone. And it is a sort of a road movie type thing, or you set some other goal based on Iron Maiden lyrics, or maybe, you know, you have to cross the streams and rescue a veteran of 1,000 psychic wars at some point. I don't know what you got to do. You're the Iron Maiden fan, but that is how you do it.
Lightning round.
Andrew Miller asks, the week got away from you and your grand plans for those vegetables have not come to pass. You have to use them all tonight. What do you do?
I think depending on the vegetables, that is the stir fry answer, or depending on the vegetables, the calabacitas answer. It's a New Mexican vegetable stew. It's delicious. Really depends on having enough corn to make all the other vegetables play nice. If you got a ton of vegetables, that's going to be a ton of calabacitas, but maybe you got friends who want to come over and hopefully one of them will bring the pork to go with. But yeah, that's what I would say. Robin?
I'm going to chunk them all in roast pan and roast them all up.
Lightning round.
Dirk the Dice asks, which book on the shelves do you keep going back to when in deep research for the podcast? Is there one golden source that just keeps on giving? Robin?
The Collected Works of Charles Fort.
For me, it is the Geobibliography of Anomalies by George M. Eberhardt. I have plugged this before. Its only flaw is that it cuts off in 1980, but it is everything from ghosts to UFOs to psychic experiments organized down to the town level in America and Canada. So a great resource for, were there ghosts in Decatur, Georgia in the 1800s? And I suppose the answer is yes, but if I wanted to know for sure, I just have to look in the book.
Lightning round!
Jonathan Loveswiler also asks, have you ever tried putting a smoking piece of charcoal in your Instant Pot?
I have not, Robin.
No, not me either.
Lightning round!
Irene Dels asks a question for Robin. Will there be more Adventures of the Technician? Did he abandon politics in disgust? What new or old Carcosan horrors lurk in the world of Aftermath?
I do want to write another one. This is in my series that starts with The Missing and the Lost and then Fifth Imperative. It is conceived as a series, but it requires me to have time to go off and do something that's essentially a labor of love for myself and for Kat. The through line of that character is, in fact, that he constantly trying to not be involved in politics, but his pull is that he must be drawn into it. And I do have an idea for the third one, but I'm not going to give it away.
Lightning round!
Scott Stefanski asks, what's the latest on Ken's proposed game Hellenistica?
The latest is that beloved publisher John Hodgson and I were very excited to do it. And then John looked for some angel funding for it and could not find it. I am not quite willing to write a whole book on spec to put it into crowdfunding, nor do I have the time, in fact, to do so. So we are sitting in a position of benign neglect of that manuscript. And at some point, maybe I will finish enough of it to get it kickstarted, or maybe I will be able to recruit a co-author who can inspire me to finish the rest of it in time to get it to Kickstarter. But either way, Kickstarter demands a full manuscript, not unreasonably, and I do not have time to write a full manuscript. I want high fantasy investigative adventure.
But Ken, there's only one of you.
I got you there. You are a GM, Robin.
You do have me there.
And a GM and a player is all you need for Paragon Blade, the gumshoe one-to-one game of swords and spells.
In the Paragon Blade from fantasy master Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, you play a hero in a fantastical land, still scarred by the evil of the fallen hellbound empire.
Mystery and magic collide in tales of conspiratorial wizards, monstrous foes, and arcane intrigue.
Gather your wits, your allies, and your blade.
Three advantages see you through the perils that await.
A trusty companion, a wise mentor, a stalwart servant, or cryptic ally.
A relic from the dark days of old, a treacherous artifact of terrible power.
And most of all, you're a hero of great skill and insight. You'll read the riddle of this broken world and battle evil in all its many forms.
Paragon Blade includes all the rules you need for an intense head-to-head experience in the fantasy vein.
Plus, detailed guidance on building your own heroes and quests.
Fits superbly with virtual tabletops.
Comes with three scenarios with the heroes designed to plumb their mysteries.
Barbarian hero Khan the Unslain must race against time to seek a cure for a demonic curse in Heart of the Beast.
Alethea the Scholar must conceal her sorcerer's powers from her father the Magistrate while helping him investigate the Isle of Death.
Puck the Thief must steal the Jar of Doom before anyone else opens it.
Paragon Blade, now available at the Palgrain web store.
Or at a discerning game retailer near you.
Lightning Round!
Nikolai asks, when traveling to international conventions, what local gaming trend or style outside the Anglosphere surprised or impressed you, Robin?
This is gaming adjacent, but at Ropicon in Finland, the idea that there's a formal ball where everybody gets dressed up and there's dancing was very impressive and speaks to the unique qualities of Finnish role-playing culture.
The thing that surprised and impressed me about Brazil's gaming trends and styles is that Brazil has a large enough market that they don't have to care what anyone else thinks. I saw the same thing actually in French role-playing. They had a role-playing game, for example, about the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which I cannot imagine travels outside France. And so it always impresses me that people in a nation that is not English-speaking don't just translate our stuff, that it's not all Cthulhu and dungeoning, that there's also stuff that they're immediately concerned about. And that always turns out to be more interesting than their take on dungeoning, and often more interesting than their take on Cthulhu.
Lightning Round!
Sam Harris asks, is there a literary heir to John le Carré?
Well, literally, Nick Harkaway, his son, who is not only writing his own spy and thriller fiction, but continuing to use his father's characters. I have yet to read him. He's on my reading list. I can't attest to what extent he succeeds or fails at that. I think that the issue, though, is that there's no new le Carré, because le Carré needed the Cold War. And after the Cold War, even John le Carré wasn't John le Carré anymore. And the post-Cold War question mark and then the global war on terror do not really lend themselves to the spy novel. In particular, the global war on terror is more of a techno-thriller geopolitics. And the new, there's plenty of spy stuff back. Espionage is back big time in the, you know, resurgence of authoritarianism era, but we haven't found our poet laureate of that yet. So we'll have to keep our eyes and ears out.
Yeah, the closest thing, I think, is a guy named Charles Cumming, who writes terrific spy novels, but they're all set in the Cold War. And he also, unlike Le Carré, and I think this is the other half of the heir question, our heir to Le Carré probably needs to be a veteran of one of the other spy services. And as of so far, we have not gotten a good writer out of those guys, and certainly not a level of writer equal to Le Carré. So, you know, good luck, all you G7s in the CIA. Keep those manuscripts humming. But for right,
well,
now,
there's a bunch of people who are just cashiered. Maybe they've been working on their novel.
Lightning round!
Ludovic Chavant asks, as a GM, do you take notes as you go during the session or in bulk after the players are gone?
Well, I take notes as I go during the session. It's the only way I'm going to remember the name that I just gave that GMC. And sometimes I will be, like, for example, last night, I was researching a Venetian family because the players were involved in them, in their business, and I noticed that they'd married into the Loredans, the family that is the patron of one of the player characters, increasingly less willingly, but still, you can't get out once you're in. And so there was a marriage connection, and so I needed to introduce that NPC to establish that marriage connection really fast, and also I had to write it down so that I knew that these two storylines would, as is the great thing about Venice, overlap and intertwine and anger the players, and that's the best part. Robin?
During my current campaign, Marisher Detective Club, I have foisted all note-taking onto the players. And because there's a map that we're creating ourselves for the village on Miro, they have finally taken to note-taking now that they can see each other do notes in real time. So that's very exciting. I will jot down character names and that's about it. But for this campaign, I essentially come in with all the character names in point form. In other games where I do the note-taking, I do it during the session. After the session, I don't want to sit down and try and remember what happened.
Lightning round!
Bart Malio asks, how much of a book should I read before I can say I gave it a chance and bag it without shame? Robin?
I used to read up to the 15% mark and then evaluate whether I wanted to continue or not. Sometimes I will get partway through a book, further than that, and go, oh, wait a minute, this isn't what I signed up for, or this isn't developing, and I'll put it down. I say, first of all, life is too short. There's too many books. You don't have a teacher paying attention to this. There is no shame ever in stopping reading a book. The real shame is in not picking up another book because you're stuck in a book you're not enjoying. These days, now that I'm back to doing more editing work, I will stop a book at the first sentence I encounter that I would ask a Pelgrain writer to rewrite. And that can be a very short turndown.
Yeah, the second line.
Ken?
Yep, for a nonfiction book, it's you read the introduction, you read the conclusion. If that either doesn't sound like your brand of vodka or the author is being meretricious and lazy, then stop right there. For a fiction book, I think Robin's 15% mark is fair, but much like Robin, I have certainly noped out of a book earlier than that. If rather than would I ask a Pelgrain writer to change it, my question is sometimes would I ask that writer to walk into traffic? And that's not an attitude that I want to have in my leisure time. So it's better for them and me if I simply let them go on with their happy life and we remain mutually unattached.
Lightning round!
Jackson Kishbaumesh asks, what system would you use for a campaign set in H.G. Wars' War of the Worlds?
During the actual war, Savage Worlds, during the post-war triumphant reconstruction where you suspect Martian involvement everywhere, Gumshoe, of course, probably Knights Black Agents because the Martians are vampires. Robin?
Well, realistically speaking, at this point, I would do Gumshoe too, just because I don't have the spoons to do things that don't filter directly into Pelgrain at this point.
Lightning round!
Ross Ireland asks, assuming you had time, funding, and inclination to do so, which cryptid would you base a TTRPG around? Robin?
So my first answer would be what do you mean only one cryptid?
Exactly.
What kind of possible game could you have where you could be only one cryptid? You want a whole team of cryptids. And so clearly, I can't premise reject this question, so clearly Ross is asking for a gumshoe one-to-one book featuring a cryptid. And therefore, the cryptid has to be a chupacabra, because he's going around accidentally solving crimes while looking for goats to feed on. Well, possibly ghosts and goats, because there's got to be at least three adventures in the chupacabra one-to-one.
Can right, you? Yeah. And the adventure of the inarticulate food source is certainly one of them. I would base it around Mothman because he is the best cryptid. And rather than playing Mothman, Mothman would be a type, much like a dragon. You don't fight just dragons in Dungeons and Dragons. So a Mothman Prophecies or Mothman Reality Horror RPG would center on Mothman. Mothman would be the pinnacle. But yeah, there'd be chupas, there'd be yetis, there'd be Nessies, there'd be all manner of stuff. But Mothman and the whole question of the ultra-terrestrial would be the animate feature of this reality horror game.
Lightning round!
Darcy asks, I feel like I might be poking a hornet's nest, but what's Ken's opinion of the Obama Presidential Library?
Well, first of all, it's not a presidential library. It does not fall under the National Archives. It is a presidential center. Get it right. Second of all, Obama should have put it in Washington Park, the neighborhood where he did some of his community organizing and which could actually use a influx of visitors and capital instead of Tony academic goo-goo liberal Hyde Park where I and he lived. So it's in the wrong place. And third of all, you know, if Director Krennic thinks that's where they need to hide the Death Star plans, then far be it from me to question it. But it is objectively hideous. Haven't gone in. It's not open yet.
Lightning round!
Robbie Carlton asks, in Robin's recent review of House of Dynamite, you say the techno-thriller genre only makes sense if set before the end of the Obama years. Please expand on that, Robin.
So the Hollywood techno-thriller has a couple of core assumptions, one of which is that the American government is basically good, that the president is going to be basically good, or when there is, as is often the case, a enemy element within the American government, that it is a rogue element of which being expunged is the final outcome. And also, a techno thriller is competence porn, that the protagonists of the government, of the security services or the military, are ultra competent and know what they're doing. And we don't have sort of an Armando Iannucci level even of, you often have the pencil neck fool, you know, being a minor barrier to the techno thriller hero, but you don't have the fact that the entire administration to more than half the audience and outside of America, the vast majority of the audience regards as themselves corrupt and villainous and incompetent. And, you know, you don't have a high FEMA official who thinks that he's regularly apported to Waffle Houses. That's Dr. Strangelove. That is not the techno thriller at all. And the real life violates too many principles of that. Now, in other countries, the techno thriller can continue. For example, in China, where the Americans are the bad guys, that somehow makes a little more sense than it did before and certainly makes perfect sense to a Chinese audience. But the basic assumptions of the techno-thriller genre have been overtaken by history.
I would say that if we haven't seen a green light on the F-15 pilot rescue, we're going to, and we will see if that can overcome the objections that you pose.
Lightning round!
Bob Grider asks, does Ken Haidt appearing as Kenneth Haidt, spelling change presumably for plausible deniability, in Elden Ring, indicate a new off-branch of Time Incorporated that will be exploring constructed worlds, or was he there for other research?
First of all, Bob, stop messing around listening to podcasts and go recapture my fort. Second of all, Time Incorporated has its hands full with alternate timelines and with alternate timeline research. So what I do in my free time from Time Incorporated, none of your business, quite frankly, but we explore constructed worlds in many other huts And if we are starting to alter constructed worlds, an alternate history, for example, in which Lord Peter Wimsey is American or something, that sounds like a whole new bolus of podcast topics that we probably don't want to get into. Robin?
I have no idea what you're doing in Elden Ring.
Lightning round!
John D. asks, what kind of food is always better at a restaurant versus made at home? Robin?
And this is due to great lack of encouragement, I must say, but most seafood dishes I have not learned to do properly. So like a lobster, I would much rather have that done at a restaurant. And so I will occasionally do like a rock lobster tail in the Instant Pot, but that's no patch on any lobster I've been served in a restaurant. And also, and when I think of this, it's mostly more about the labor, right? It's like, do I want to learn to shuck oysters, cutting my hands that number of times? I got as far as getting an oyster knife and some oysters and went, you know what? This is a restaurant experience. Yeah. There are other dishes that used to be on that list that the Instant Pot has removed from the list, like risotto, for example. Ken?
Mole is the classic example for me. I made it once. It took 2 days. It was impossible. It took a million billion ingredients. And the mole that I made was about 70% as good as the mole at any good Mexican restaurant in Pilsen. And not even as good, frankly, as the mole that comes in a can. So I said, you know what? From now on, I'm eating all of my mole out, and I have never regretted that decision. Play the King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, the King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com.
Lightning round!
Jeff asks, what system would be best for a samurai and child, lone wolf and cub, the Mandalorian and Grogu, etc. narrative? Does the answer change if the child is also a PC? Ken, how do we do the rifleman?
Well, the trouble with the rifleman is that procedural mechanics are a bigger deal in both lone wolf and cub and the rifleman than they are in the sort of standard Gumshoe one-to-one. But I feel like Gumshoe one-to-one is still getting a lot of the problem solved that you would need to solve for it. If the cub or Grogu or whoever is also a PC, then it backs out to whatever system you are using that elides differences in power level best for you. So maybe a good Supers engine is actually the right answer because it has to deal with characters of wildly different power levels. So maybe I would say Icons is the direction I might go. But at some level, you're basically making a even more than Knights Black Agent solo ops one-to-one game with a final epic confrontation built into it. Robin?
You could certainly do samurai duels in Gumshoe. It would require some additional rules work. You could certainly also do it in one-to-one. So yes, if the child is not a PC, one-to-one is the way I would go with that. The caveat there is for Mandalorian and Grogu, you know what? Star Wars.
Yeah.
Use the Star Wars system. That makes sense.
Lightning round!
Jason Krause asks, Ray Winninger's Underground, revolutionary or unplayable? Robin?
I've played it. So, revolutionary. Ken?
Haven't played it, but also revolutionary.
Lightning round!
Chris Mead asks, what's the 30-second Ken's time machine solution to the enduring problems that flow from the post-Ottoman partition of the Arab world?
I don't know that you can do it in 30 seconds. I might start by making the Hussein dynasty in charge of Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Iraq and see if that created a sensible power base that you could use to bolster civilized thought in those areas. I might also go back and say, you know what? We're not going to overthrow the Ottomans. We're going to let them stagger along for a while into modernity and see if that creates a better system. I don't have a great deal of faith in either of those outcomes, but I also don't think that the present is a lot to write home about. And clearly letting the British do it was a bad idea.
Lightning round!
Paul Douglas asks, would Robin's mooted retirement mean the end of this podcast?
Well, it is not my intention for the last episode of this podcast to consist of Ken tearfully recounting how great the Architecture Hut segment was until I dropped dead in the middle of it. So, yes.
Lightning round!
Steve Dempsey says, one of my friends doesn't like risotto because it's all just the same throughout the dish. Presumably, they don't like soup or milkshakes either. But would it work as a side dish, and what with?
I have questions about this risotto that they're theoretically getting. Are they sure it's not just rice pudding? Because risotto's got stuff in it a lot of times. I mean, there's, you know, duck risotto has duck in it, for example. Mushroom risotto has mushrooms in it. There's all manner of fun things to find in a risotto. But yes, risotto does work as a side dish. You just have to have enough people over that it's worth making a whole risotto and then giving them a small one to go along with the veal or chicken or whatever the main dish is. Because what you don't want to do is provide a main dish that then overpowers the risotto, because then you've wasted a great deal of work. Robin?
And again, as I've already said in this year podcast, it's no longer a great deal of work now that the Instant Pot exists. So I would definitely do either a vegetarian or perhaps mushroom risotto. And that would pair with anything that works well with Parmesan cheese. So that could be anything from shrimp or a seafood medley to pretty much any kind of meat. And certainly for the vegetarians at the table, they get your delightful vegetarian risotto, which has all sorts of different things in it. And it's different in every single bite.
Lightning round!
Friend of the podcast, Doc Cross, asks, new James Bond movies or remake the originals, Robin?
Well, they just remade the originals. And by all accounts, highly trusted accounts, which I followed because I do not wish to be completely annoyed by the wrecking of a franchise I love, they were terrible. The other thing that I'm sure every single director who's hired on to reboot Bond says in the meeting is, let's do new Bond stories set in Bond's era in the early 60s. And the executives say, we need merchandising tie-ins with watch companies, and they do not want to market their 1963 watches. Everybody tells us to do this, and we always say no. What's your second pitch? Ken?
Yeah, new James Bond movies. I wouldn't trust anyone working today to remake View to a Kill, much less From Russia with Love. So no, don't remake originals. Write a new Bond movie. How hard is it? He's a sadistic sociopath who works for Great Britain. I mean, look at the frickin' headlines.
Lightning round!
Matthew Ruane asks, how would the modernization of the Civil War era Lamotte revolver have changed the history of the American West? Ken, what is the Lamotte revolver?
The Lamotte revolver is the dumbest, most fiddly weapon ever fielded. Depending on the Lamotte, I believe it had between 7 and 12 bullets in this immense wheel of a cylinder. Often it had a shotgun, a very small gauge shotgun barrel in the middle. It was insanely stupid. I believe it was made by a Belgian gun maker, almost exclusively used by Southern cavalrymen. It was sort of a Patek Philippe type gun that was prestige. So the modernization of it would have had to involve making it less like the Lamotte revolver, because the whole point of a modern weapon is you can build it on an assembly line. Also, the thing that civilized the American West was the breech-loading rifle, not even the Colt Peacemaker. So I premise reject, but if the good people at Lamotte had built a high capacity revolver. I think that the machine tooling and everything else that they would have needed to make that a reliable weapon would have better served them into making a competitor for the Gatling gun, not a hand cranked 12 bullet cylinder. Robin?
The thing about guns is that they are highly restricted by the laws of physics. And enough people were working on guns and have worked on guns through history that if somebody was almost going to invent a better gun, they would have. So there's no alternate timelines that were changed by different guns that don't exist in our timeline, because only the guns that make it to mass production and change things are the guns that can exist.
Lightning round!
Leonardo Giannoni asks, what is the most occult of plants that are apartment friendly, Robin?
The most occult of plants, you would think, would be possibly the spider plant, because spiders are creepy and occult. The hardiest plant in your house with a cool occult slash D&D slash metal vibe, of course, is the snake plant, which even I've managed not to kill. I'm looking at one right now. But ultimately, it is the Christmas cactus. It is occult in that it lays back looking merely cactusy for perhaps 11 months out of the year, and then spectacularly flowers and reveals its true nature, just like a spiritual secret. Ken?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on, do you have small children or pets? Because most of your best occult plants are all poisonous. I'm pretty sure you can grow hellebore indoors, for example, and that would be pretty darned occult. But again, it's deadly poison. I think that if you want to be occult and apartment friendly, get a good herb garden. Most of the herbs are also magic. So, you know, your sage, your vervain, your mint, all of that stuff has got occult meaning and fun messages you send. And then it also, of course, will make your Italian sauce very tasty.
Lightning round!
Martin Rundquist asks, what are some of your current opinions about the RPG hobby that would have surprised you in 1980?
In 1980, I think I would have been amazed that there were games about anything except killing people in dramatic and exciting ways. That would have been a bit of a mind opener. Even Great Traveler, as great as Traveler was, I think in 1980, I was not quite aware of the possibility of Traveler for empire building and other stuff that was not shooting aliens. 1980, I hasten to remind everyone, I was 15. A lot of stuff would have surprised me, I'm sure. The putative elder statesman of gaming that I might have been in an alternate 1980, you know, I'm sure would be more delighted than surprised at the level of creativity that continues to unfold. The thing that surprises me is that the golden age that began in 2000 shows no sign of stopping. You don't usually get a golden age that lasts a generation. Robin?
Well, yes, from 1980, I would be startled. My first opinion that would startle me is I'm in this hobby as a job. It's my career, and I'm making a living at it. That would shock the dickens out of me. I think that I'm going to advance the timeline slightly to when I started, to in the early 90s. The thing that has changed the most that I specifically have said wouldn't happen or you know, didn't imagine happening and didn't imagine it in print was the growth of role-playing as a passively enjoyed entertainment, which turns out to vastly increase the audience if you could just watch other people doing it. I still don't think that's happening, yet clearly it is.
Lightning round!
The Molten Sulfur blog poses the question, thoughts on Detroit-style pizza?
I very much enjoy the Detroit-style pizza that I get from a place called Detroit Pizza, about six blocks north of me. I don't know if they have this one in Detroit, though, because it sounds very Toronto version of Detroit pizza. My favorite one of theirs, and there's a number that I like, is their Korean fried chicken Detroit pizza. It is delicious.
There are fancy high-end Detroit pizza places I know. I don't know how many of them are in Detroit, fair enough. But I am perfectly content with Jets, which I think is the biggest Detroit-style pizza around, and we have one in the neighborhood. So it's like you said, five or six blocks, not even that really, north of me. So I'm happy to get Jets, and I'm happy to enjoy Detroit-style pizza every now and again. What I really want is focaccia bread with pizza toppings on it.
Lightning round!
Oren Gashuri asks, with apologies to Tom Waits, what is that guy actually building in there?
A better life for he and his kids. Robin?
What he's building in there is a device that keeps the entire universe in balance. He's been building it forever. He's immortal. the building must never stop or the world will go out of balance. And the problem is he has to feed it ghosts. And he's getting a little, his leg is starting to hurt him, and his wife deserted him a few years ago, and he's running out of vodka, and he's going to run out of ghosts.
Lightning round!
Michael Kewell asks, in a regular game, weekly, monthly, whatever, which is a continuing campaign, how close to the start of game do you outline what you're going to throw at the players? Days? Hours? Minutes? How close has it got, Robin?
So in some games, the answer is zero. For example, if it's drama system, I will think for a moment what my first scene will be, but that's as much prep as you can do in drama system. In other games, I'll have to, you know, when I was running RuneQuest, it would be getting all of the stats together and, you know, getting the maps for the encounter and so forth. And so in general, I play on Tuesdays. The game is at 7, and I will finish my whatever stuff I have at the end of recording this podcast, which is also on Tuesdays. So around 5, I have 2 hours, including also having a meal and last minute straightening up to get ready for a game. And so that is the amount of time that I have to prep. And sometimes I need a whole 90 minutes. Sometimes I need nothing because I did all the work last week. And sometimes I need about 20 minutes. Ken?
Often I will have a good idea that I want to put in, and I will have written it down in the campaign notes, and I'm just waiting for a chance to unleash it when it makes sense. More often, the beginning of the adventure or the beginning scene or the bit that they're going to encounter, that is my decision. Often it's all the player's decision and I'm just reacting, which is great. But that initial encounter, we'll call it that, forms as I go to where the game is. And that used to be about a 20-minute walk from my house to where the game was. Now it's an hour and change bus and train ride to where the game is. Have the adventures gotten better? Have they gotten worse? You'd have to ask my players, but that's when I'm thinking about it.
The British are coming
to the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com.
Lightning round!
Beloved Patreon backer Nick Eaton asks, just what is a fast-moving hex crawl?
Well, a hex crawl, of course, is an outdoor F-20 adventure named after the hexes on the wilderness map. You're going from one wilderness encounter or outdoor encounter, I guess, in the case of Nations and Cannons, that you're probably fighting Hessians rather than owl bears. And fast moving, I think, probably means, I'm sure it means, that all of the things that slow down in F-20 combat have been taken out in favor of revolutionary fervor.
Yeah, I assume that a fast moving hex crawl is one where you get to the encounter without a lot of tedious marching. So there's probably some travel foreshortening tips and tools. I assume robust random tables. That's another way to make a hex crawl fast moving, because then you can generate the encounter really fast. And finally, it's fast moving because you're using gunpowder, not the naked blade. And gunpowder tends to make combat faster, even in musket times, because you get hit with a musket bullet. You're not necessarily getting up, even if you are an owlbear.
Lightning round!
Dylan Galt says, Ken once said that the one thing that Subway sandwich artists did right is that they didn't put the cheese next to the bread. Why shouldn't the cheese be next to the bread?
Because it creates a seal between the cheese and the bread, and the cheese therefore does not inform the rest of the sandwich. It's just gummed up against the bread. Also, if you'd had a condiment under there, the condiment can't touch any of the other things in the sandwich. Cheese belongs in the middle of the sandwich. The exception, I guess, would be a grilled cheese sandwich, but I'm sure that Dylan Galt would not pettifog to that level. Robin?
You've said it, man. Lightning round!
Chris Mead asks, you are the unquestioned leader of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for 1 year. What do you do, Robin?
So whatever I do can be undone by others. So I can't, for example, say that the return to the actual good memorial montage has to be permanent, because that's someone else can undo that. Mm-hmm. But that would be my number one thing, is just make sure that the what they did this year happens in perpetuity. You know, singing over the in memoriam, show actual frickin' clips. That would be my number one priority. But it's not possible under the terms of this question. So I would finalize whatever had to be finalized to have an Oscar for stunts, which I would assume would be stunt coordinator or action director. And the other thing I would do is, just for others, I've already seen a version of this here in Toronto, I would give others the opportunity to see a David Cronenberg exhibit at their museum. Ken?
Well, as you say, whatever I do could be undone by the next person. So, you know, there's no point in making John Mulaney the host of the Oscars. First of all, Conan's doing a fine job. No reason to replace him. You know, meet movie stars, obviously. But I think that the most important thing that the chairman of the Academy could do is lobby like hell for the city of Los Angeles and the state of California to start removing the wearing puffy shirt taxes that are making filming and production in Los Angeles vastly more expensive than even other places in America, much less Bulgaria. It is now cheaper to fly your entire above the line team of filmmakers to Bulgaria, Romania to make a movie than it is to make a movie in LA. That has to stop, or else Hollywood basically gets hollowed out and we're only going to be caring what the leader of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in Bombay and Lagos think. So, yeah, that's what I would do, is make a giant screaming deal out of how crazily expensive it is to produce movies and television and other filmed entertainment in the City of Angels.
Lightning round!
Roberto Hoyle asks, whatever happened to Senator Haidt? Did he retire, or is he running for re-election this year?
I feel like Senator Haidt is probably one of those guys who's, you know, he's done his time. Oklahoma is a safe Republican seat. He doesn't have to run for re-election to keep the Senate. So, yeah, I think Senator Haidt is maybe exploring a future in sitting on oil and gas boards and fishing and reading Louis L'Amour novels. That's my theory on Senator Haidt.
Yeah, I think there's some chance that he went full Cheney, but probably just he looked at the primaries and realized he wasn't quite crazy enough. And I thought he would be lobbying for the chemical industry, but, you know, why not both?
Right.
Lightning round!
Gabriel Rossman asks, when will there be a Gumshoe cyberpunk game? Robin?
Because I know the answer, I can't tell you.
Lightning round!
Michael David Jr. asks, what does science fiction role-playing look like in a world where Star Wars either wasn't made or wasn't successful?
The answer is Traveler is what it looks like, because that is what the science fiction role-playing was before Star Wars. Maybe a little bit of Metamorphosis Alpha, if you're nice. I'm sure that at some level there would have been, obviously plenty more Star Trek is out there as well. So, yeah, it looks basically like science fiction with a little more science fiction and a little less fantasy in it, and probably a third the audience.
You were right with your first word, which was Traveler.
Lightning round!
Ed Sizemore asks, is Donovan's song Mellow Yellow an attempt to summon the Yellow King?
Well, yes, of course. But the real things that you have to worry about are Hurdy-Gurdy Man, which summons the Zodiac Killer, and Atlantis, which in certain circumstances leads you, even though you've just gotten out of jail, to provoke a psychopathic killer by telling him to go home and get his shine box and get you beaten to death. Ken?
Also, be on the lookout for the Season of the Witch. Frankly, Donovan is a unexploded munition just waiting to happen, especially if you've got a vibey sort of a Fall of Delta Green game going on.
Lightning round!
Elias Helfer asks, what is a prop/handout/special effect that you feel is underutilized or has untapped potential?
I have always been a big fan of the calendar. I don't know why more games don't just assume, especially horror games, here is a calendar, here are your full moons, here is how long the ship is going to take to get here from Romania, allowing players to plan in multiple dimensions. And I sometimes try to encourage it, and we almost get like, oh, the new moon's in a month, I guess we'd better think about that, and then they don't. So it'd be nice if the calendar was more utilized, especially in real worldy horror-y sorts of games. Eclipses. Who doesn't want to know when an eclipse is? Robin?
I think stickers, which are these days apparently pretty easy to print. And I think if I understand correctly, even on your home printer, you can probably print stickers fairly easily, or you can cheaply have them printed. And a game in which your character sheet or your character history, at least, was just a series of stickers that you'd earned, and you had to show how one of your stickers applied to give you a bonus in a particular situation, I think could make a fun, cute gimmick for a game.
Lightning Round!
Kim Farrell asks, we just finished the Paris setting in the Yellow King, and my character ended up being rather banal. Tips to quickly amp her concept up for the next campaign frame?
So I would zero in on whatever you thought was disappointing about that character. What moment where they could have done something interesting did they not do it because that was them? And then because the characters are supposed to be echoes of each other, basically create someone who's the polar opposite of that character. And so, you know, in another genre, in another world, it would be their evil twin, but someone who is exactly like them, except completely different. So go the complete opposite direction. Ken?
Well, fortunately, the next segment is the wars. So I think that even the most banal character, if translated into someone who's going through a continent-rending war, is going to have something going on. I don't think it has to be the same character. It's that character's like reincarnation, right, Robin? So you just reincarnate only the cool parts and leave the banal parts back in Paris where it belongs.
Lightning Round!
Andrew Reichardt asks, what's your favorite technique for signposting a setting in the very recent past, like 5 to 10 years?
In play, it can be as simple as playing a song that was big 5 or 10 years ago, gets people into the mood, lets them remember it. One of the, I guess, good question mark things about culture basically being static in terms of design and everything else is you don't really usually need to signpost the setting being only 5 or 10 years old unless it's a political thriller in which who is president and who runs Congress is more immediately relevant. But again, you can just say it's 2020, you know, Trump won, is in power. This is your story. Let's go. Or your story is, you know, this is the closing years of the Obama administration. What do you do, Delta Green? Question mark. And that would open it up just as well as anything else. Robin?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would ever, like, the reason to put it in a particular very recent past is just to, I don't know, make a technic thriller viable or have it ping off a particular world event. So I'm not sure I would go to a lot of trouble to make that happen. But I guess if it mattered, but it wasn't a specific event, I would look on YouTube for like a news recap from that night to get people into the mood for that. Because even like movies or songs, like I don't remember what, like if I hear a relatively recent song, I don't know, it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I'm often like I think the New Pornographers are still a new band.
Yeah.
Right. What do I know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would think I would either ignore the issue or I would find a news report on YouTube.
Lightning Round!
Thomas Vallejos asks, what is your favorite World War II movie and why? Robin?
So I normally leave off favorite questions, but I put this one on because I had an answer. In fact, I have two answers. My second favorite is Operation Burma, directed by Roald Walsh with Errol Flynn. My first is They Were Expendable, directed by John Ford with John Wayne. And I like these for the same reason, which is that they were made during the war. And so they have that sense of doom and fear and sacrifice that are part of being in a real war that then vanish once America wins the war and all war movies about that war then become a retrospective, and even the ones that are tackling its hellish nature still do it through the lens of this is a sacrifice we made in order to win and do this super important thing. But the sense of dread hanging over those films is something that is not just great unto themselves, but really captures a moment that would otherwise not be captured.
I will preface this by saying I have not yet seen The Big Red One. I'm waiting to see it on the big screen for the first time. That said, my favorite World War II movie, embarrassingly enough, is probably Guns of Navarone, for the opposite of every reason you just gave, Robin. I just love the zippiness of it. When Eagles Dare is in that same mix, that same sort of almost World War II is long enough ago that it's an adventure setting, not a gripping setting of terror. Obviously, I love a good in the mix World War II movie. And if you, you know, expand the definition a little bit, Casablanca, I think, gets back into the conversation. But for me, I like World War II as adventure film. And so Guns of Navarone or Dirty Dozen, any of those, Kelly's Heroes, any of those sorts of films, I like because I like the aesthetic and the notion of a serious movie about a serious war often starts well, a la Saving Private Ryan, but then sort of just descends into placidity if you try and make it now, a la Saving Private Ryan.
So this is our 700th episode. This is our lightning. And we have to wrap up by, as always, thanking the Patreon backers. Usually we thank 10 specific backers, but this time around, everyone who's chipped in, currently chipping in or has chipped in the past, or even better, thinking of chipping in the near future, you've kept this podcast going. It would not have gotten to episode 700, not to episode 500, not to episode even 350 without you. So thanks, everybody, so much for making this podcast possible. And we'll be back next week with a regular, ordinary one without a single
lightning round.
Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.